Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Goofy Footer shoot the curl to prevent malaria. But first, it's not unusual for a coach to believe his experience with the youngsters on his team merits a book. On the other hand, most coaches who go ahead and write that book don't feel they have to change the names of their players to save them from deportation. High school soccer coach Paul Quadros, the author of A Home on the Field, How One Championship Team Inspires Hope for the Revival of Small-Town America, took that precaution. He joins me now from the studios of WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Paul, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
When you moved to North Carolina, it was as a reporter determined to write about the impact of immigrant workers who had moved there to work in chicken processing plants, not as a soccer coach. How did you get drawn into that job?
Well, I moved to a rural community and to a small town of about 2,000, although the place where I coach is a population of 7,000. And I was bored. I ended up playing and coaching in a local soccer league. And from there, I met a group of boys, Latino boys from Siler City, and I began to coach them. And as they began to grow up and get into high school, we realized there was no high school team there.
Why not? Jordan Matthews High School in Siler City, why didn't it have a soccer team?
Well, Siler City is a very traditional southern town. And the local high school had the traditional sports, football, baseball, basketball. And it saw soccer as being very much a foreigner's sport. And they had never really considered it.
You had seen the boys who would be on your team play in street games. Did you know how good they would be when they had the opportunity to play on a high school team?
Definitely. It was a big motivation for me. The boys would play their cascaritas or the street ball kind of game, and you can tell that their technical ability with the ball was excellent. And they had nice creative moves. They enjoyed playing. They had a real joy for the game. And what they needed was discipline, tactics, and really being able to play on a full-size field or a big field and playing the real game as opposed to just sort of backyard street soccer.
Paul, all coaches face challenges, and some of them have to worry about which players will show up on a given day for various reasons. But tell us about the particular worries that you had regarding your keeper, whom you call Fish, as he tried to get back to Siler City in time to register for school.
Yeah, I had run into Fish in July, right before school started, and he announced to me that he was heading back to Mexico because his grandmother was ill. And he wasn't sure if he was going to make it back in time to start school or even to come back at all. And Fish left, and we had no keeper. We were trying to find who could actually take over in that position. Meanwhile, he was going through his own experience of trying to get back into the United States and having to cross the border in Arizona through the desert. And that's not an easy journey. I've been to the border. I've seen it. It's very, very rugged terrain. People die there. People die of dehydration. People are robbed there. People are raped. All kinds of things can happen at the border. And so I wasn't sure if Fish was going to make it back in time for the season or even make it back at all or even survive.
Your team won the high school championship of North Carolina with Fish in the goal. Did that triumph contribute to the acceptance of Latinos in Siler City?
I think it did, yes. I think people were able to see the team and the success of the team. They were able to see those Latino boys not just as Latino boys, but really as Jets, as members of their community and of their high school. So it allowed them to accept and embrace that win and that championship. And I think that that's really helped the town in terms of accepting these boys.
And the appearance of the high school literally changed because along with all of the other pictures of championship teams, yours got up on the wall, right?
Right. JM, like many schools in the South, when a team wins a state championship, they'll take a photograph of the team and they will blow it up to gigantic proportions. we're talking like 7 feet by 5 feet, 6 feet. And for me, a big motivating factor in getting the guys to work hard and to keep their discipline was to get our own picture on that wall so that they could see faces that looked like their own.
At several points in the book, you write that you want to give your players something they can be proud of and something that will help them succeed in their futures well beyond high school. To what extent do you feel you accomplished that?
That's a good question. I think I was able to do that. Really the boys were able to do that on their own. They're the ones, you know, I tell them that I won't play a single minute of any game. They're the ones who are playing all the games. So the achievements are really their own. And what I really wanted to do was I knew that they would face all kinds of obstacles in their lives. Many of them would graduate from high school, the first in their families. Others are unauthorized to be in the United States, so their residency status is in question. And their dreams of playing soccer, football in college or even going to college are in question. And so becoming champions, I thought and I think today, would help them, insulate them and protect them and inspire them to overcome anything that they have to face for the rest of their lives.
What are the limitations on the kids who, even after they've graduated from high school, are undocumented?
Well, it's interesting because when they're in high school, they can use their real names. They live in the real world very openly. But as they approach the end of their senior year, they know that they have to slip into the shadows because they're unauthorized. And you can see that they're burdened by it, that they have to quietly go into this underground world that their fathers and mothers may be in. It really dashes their hopes in terms of going to college. Many of them have excellent grades. Many of them are excellent athletes and could play on Division I, Division II teams. So once they begin to slip away from high school, they know they're entering into a different world.
You know, it strikes me, listening to you talk about this, a lot of people, the kids and the families of the kids who played against your teams must have had very strong feelings about whether those kids should have been in the United States at all. Did they make those feelings known during games?
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, they definitely did. Sometimes they would shout, you know, very terrible things at the boys. And sometimes they would shout very amusing things. And I think one of the most amusing things was they would say, you know, don't give that kid a yellow card, give him a green card. And I would always advise the guys, you know, if it makes you feel bad, you know, just play harder, you know, just win the game.
Some of our listeners are going to hear our conversation and they're going to think, hey, wait a minute, this guy is defending the families who shouldn't be here to begin with. They came here illegally. They broke the law. They're breaking the law by living here. Did you ever have any kind of second thoughts about helping folks who were in that circumstance?
No, not for a second. I think once you realize the relationship that exists in terms of big business and its efforts to recruit foreign labor into the United States, or what I call insourcing. You know, we've all heard of outsourcing. But corporate America has been insourcing for the past 10, 15 years. The food processing industry is a major contributor to that. So people say, you know, this is an invasion. But really it's been an invitation by some of the best representatives of our country, which is corporate America. And we need to understand that meanwhile, as business has been recruiting folks, Congress and our political leaders have looked the other way. And so there's a relationship here, and it's an unspoken pact. And it seems now, once the population has increased, that many people want to square that on the backs of the very poor and the most vulnerable. And with regard to the kids, you know, if you're brought over here at 5 years old, at 6 years old, can you really be held accountable for any crime? Can we really hold these children accountable for actions that their parents take, that they have no realization of what's happening to them? Kids just come along.
Paul Quadros is the author of A Home on the Field, How One Championship Team Inspires Hope for the Revival of Small-Town America, published by HarperCollins. He spoke to me from WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Early Tuesday evening, the members of DC United, the only team that has already assured itself a spot in Major League Soccer's playoffs, file into the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel in Braintree, Massachusetts, The following night, they would play the New England Revolution. The players are tall and they are short. They are white, black, and Latino, and they are all dressed in identical dark suits. They are all wearing D.C. United lapel pins. Without saying a thing, they are making a statement about being a team. According to Ben Olson, the midfielder who's been with D.C. United since 1998, the dress code doesn't entirely explain why his team has been the league's most successful franchise.
I think, first of all, we've been very lucky. We've had some of the greatest players in the league that have come through the league, and we've had great management and a great coach in Bruce Arena, who is the national team coach at the last two World Cups, and it's kind of steamrolled from there.
The steamroller started when the league began in 1996. Under Bruce Arena, United won the first two MLS championships. They won another one in 1999 and a fourth in 2004. Jaime Moreno, the Bolivian national who stands second all-time among MLS goal scorers, has been with the team for all four championships. He thinks the attitude fostered by the team's management has a lot to do with D.C. United's success.
I think everybody who comes to D.C. just feels like a new family, and whoever comes is welcome. Everybody who joined the team has got a winning mentality that is very important to have in each team.
Evidence of D.C. United's success this season includes not only the league-leading 52 points the team has accumulated, but a win and a draw in friendly matches against Chelsea of the English Premiership and La Liga's Real Madrid, two of the top teams in the world. But since a six-game winning streak that concluded with a 3-2 victory over the Columbus Crew on July 15th, United had tied four games, lost two, and won only one going into Wednesday night's contest against New England. Still, Jaime Moreno and Ben Olson are reluctant to characterize that stretch as a full-fledged slump.
All the teams want to be DC United, so we hit a wall the last couple of games where, after the All-Star break, I think everybody was so confident, beating Chelsea and tying Real Madrid. So I think a lot of us we relax a little too much.
I'm glad we hit this semi-slump now, rather than a month from now when the playoffs start. I think we have enough time to really get back and rev things up here going into the playoffs. We've been playing okay, a little unlucky, a tough schedule, a lot of games. So we got plenty of excuses in our pockets to deal with that.
During the first half of Wednesday night's game, D.C. United didn't look as if they would need excuses. They outshot the Revolution 8-3, scored the only goal when defender Joshua Gross banged in a rebound from a Freddy Adu shot, and generally out-hustled the home team all over the field. In short, D.C. United once again looked like the team that intimidated most of the rest of MLS during several of the league's first 10 seasons. A circumstance that Stephen Goff, who covers D.C. United for the Washington Post, regards as good for everybody concerned.
You need good guys and bad guys. Not to say D.C. United is full of bad guys, but it's a team other teams want to beat. It's a team opposing fans want to beat. It's a target. It's been a couple years where there just hasn't been a dominant team, and you didn't have that passion to beat a greater opponent. So, yeah, I think if there's a heavy favorite going into the playoffs, I think it's a good thing for the league.
The heavy favorite label frayed a little during the second half of the game. New England came out looking more organized and a step quicker. In the 56th minute, the Revolution's Taylor Twellman headed a ball across the goal mouth, and Clint Dempsey slammed it into the back of the net, producing the 1-1 score that would hold through the remainder of the game. D.C. United had played its fifth draw in 8 games. Now, would Stephen Goff acknowledge that perhaps there was a reason for D.C. United fans to be concerned? Yep, he would.
Last year, they were the best team in the league for a large part of the season. They started to fade toward the end, and everyone figured, well, they're just kind of getting ready for the playoffs. But they never bounced back from that, and they went out of the playoffs pretty quickly. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
The next opportunity to see what happens with D.C. United will come tomorrow when they play the Chicago Fire, the second-place team in the Eastern Conference. Going into the weekend's games, D.C. United remains the only club to have assured themselves a spot in the playoffs, though FC Dallas and the aforementioned Fire are close to achieving that distinction. Some of the best waves in the world attract surfers from around the globe to Indonesia's Mentawai Islands. But life for indigenous people there has not been idyllic. Islanders have suffered from malaria and malnutrition for decades. A quarter of their children die from preventable or treatable diseases. Now an organization partly funded by surfers is helping the Mentawai people. Only a Game's Trish Anderton has our story.
Lance's Right is a world-famous wave. You may well have seen it, even if you've never heard of it. It's splashed across advertisements and surfing videos everywhere, the kind of glossy tube surfers live for. On a speedboat just off the coast of the Mentawais, Dave Jenkins stops to take a long, hungry look.
It's just a perfect shape. It picks up a lot of swell, and it barrels every wave. So after take off, it just creates this big barrel, and that's what most surfers dream of, getting a lot of barrels tucked inside, the ultimate adrenaline rush.
Jenkins is from New Zealand. He's a doctor, a surfer, and the founder of a humanitarian organization called Surf Aid. In 1999, Jenkins took a vacation on one of the luxury surf boats that anchor off the islands. One day, he and a friend went ashore at the nearest town, Katiet, population 400. Sitting in a sparse hotel room in the Mentawai capital of Tuapajat, he recalls seeing the signs of undernourishment and disease.
Well, we went just out of curiosity's sake into the town and realized that the situation wasn't good just by looking at the kids.
Jenkins told the head of the village he'd get his doctor's bag and hold a clinic. When he came back, 100 people were waiting. They came with tuberculosis, with worms, with malaria. Mentawais were dying every day from preventable diseases, diseases long ago vanquished in wealthier countries. Something has to be done about this, Jenkins thought, so he did. He quit a cozy job with a six-figure salary, and in January 2000, he founded Surf Aid. In a thatch-roofed wooden house in Katiet, a radio plays Mentawai music. Christina Sakiadon's three children run through the house giggling. Christina's long black hair is neatly tied back. She's wearing jeans and a black T-shirt, and she radiates competence. Christina was among the first Surf Aid volunteers in Katiet.
Membantu masyarakat bisa sehat supaya kita tahu caranya.
We can help people be healthier. We can help them understand how to fight malaria. That's why I wanted to be involved.
The symptoms of malaria include fever, chills, nausea, and vomiting. Victims can spend weeks in bed, shaking and sweating. Children who get it multiple times wind up underweight, anemic, and vulnerable to other deadly diseases. But malaria can be prevented. The mosquitoes that spread it bite at night, so insecticide-treated mosquito nets are especially effective. Volunteers like Christina distribute the nets and show families how to use them. They also teach their neighbors how to get rid of standing water where mosquitoes breed.
We showed them how to clean their yards, throw away cans, clean their houses. Now there's less malaria.
Surf Aid statistics claim a 75% drop in malaria in the villages where they've launched programs. Jenkins says local volunteers like Christina are the key because information is much more meaningful coming from a neighbor than from a Surf Aid employee.
There's an element of trust involved. So if you're going to change behavior, you must have that, otherwise it doesn't work. And also, there they are in the house. We're talking about, right, you've got to have a special place to wash your hands. Okay, here we are in your house. This is the logical place. Let's go over here. So it's interactive learning.
Helping people stay healthy takes money, and at first that was a struggle. But as the malaria program started getting results, Surf Aid started getting noticed. The surf industry saw an opportunity to do some good and boost its image at the same time. In 2004, clothing manufacturer Quiksilver sent one of its star surfers, Strider Wasilewski, on a Mentawai fundraising tour called Wave of Compassion.
I took up the offer and went for the ride, and it was pretty amazing.
Wasilewski and other surfers went deep into the Mentawai jungle. They helped out at a traveling dental clinic and visited the graves of children who'd died of malaria. Mentawai tribesmen threw them a feast, performed traditional dances for them, and lavished them with hospitality.
All they were doing was giving you everything they had, basically. Anything you wanted to be comfortable and to feel at home and to give you, you know, life almost. And you just, you know, you wanted to do the same thing for them. You want to help more, you know, when you really get in there and you see it.
That's an impulse Dave Jenkins hopes a lot of surfers will feel in the years to come. He's encouraging the local resorts and boat companies to adopt what's called a philanthropic tourism model. That could mean organizing a day for surfers to hang up malaria nets or simply donating a portion of each guest's hotel or boat bill toward community development. After all, Jenkins says, surfers already feel a passionate attachment to their favorite spots. He believes this could only strengthen it.
There are people here who come on a boat here and they live for that 2 weeks of their life every year. They have pictures at their office. And also to have the opportunity to make the world a better place by buying mosquito nets for the little kids you've seen on your holiday is an opportunity, and there's a model for it, which is good for resort business. So I think there's a real win-win potential here.
Back in Katiet, the midday sun scorches the beach. There are no cars here, nor are there any roads to drive them on. Main Street is a concrete footpath. It's lined with small, neat houses, some wooden with thatched roofs, others concrete topped with corrugated metal. Chickens and wild pigs roam the yards. As they walk into town, Dave Jenkins and Surf Aid program manager Pramina Pubalan meet a friend.
Junaidi, apagabad.
How are you doing? Jenkins asked Junaidi, a 4-year-old boy peeking out of a modest wooden house.
He looks a bit better.
He does, actually.
Yeah, he's kind of smiling.
Come here!
Junaidi runs out of his house and jumps into Jenkins' arms with a grin. 3 months ago, Junaidi was listless and showed little curiosity. Now his eyes sparkle and he tries to grab everything within reach, including Jenkins' nose. What's made the difference is a change in diet. Before, Junaidi mostly ate taro root and bananas. Jenkins urged his parents to start fishing and gathering wild spinach in the forest to enrich the boy's diet. He's delighted with the results.
Doing well, aren't you, mate? It's good.
Jenkins has big plans. He'd like to see the Mentawai people solve more health problems on their own. He'd like to see them build a strong, sustainable economy. And he'd like Surf Aid to be here, not dictating the terms of change, but helping with advice and funding when needed. It's a long-term vision with no guarantee of results. But for now, Jenkins delights in the health and happiness of one small Mentawai boy. For Only a Game, I'm Trish Anderton in Katiet, Indonesia.
Here now to discuss the week's sports news is the gentleman we refer to as the real sports guy, Charlie Pierce. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
A lot of people turned out to be ready for some football on Monday night, more, in fact, than ESPN had ever previously entertained. Proof that the network made a good investment.
Proof that we are a nation of obsessives, Bill, because ESPN took this thing and ran with it. They had a 6-hour pregame show. They had a very unremarkable football game, actually, between Minnesota and Washington, neither of whom will be particularly relevant when the snow starts to fall. But I think it's, you know, an indication that sports is a very large but very definitely a niche programming these days, and this is the biggest niche there is.
The feud between the New England Patriots and receiver Deion Branch was supposed to be resolved when Branch signed with the Seattle Seahawks and the Pats in return, got a first-round draft choice, but no.
No, there's a lot of ugliness going on. The Patriots have filed a grievance against Branch. They want $730,000 back. Branch's people are saying the Patriots really monkeyed with the negotiations at one point, calling him alone and saying he should get rid of his agent. This was an ugly thing. The New England Patriots seem to think that they are smarter than everybody else who's ever walked within 50 feet of a football. And quite honestly, they didn't handle this very well, and now they've got probably the best quarterback in the NFL with virtually no wide receivers.
Your characterization of the Pats notwithstanding, is this kind of business as usual around the NFL? Do other teams do this same sort of thing?
Not to the extent the Patriots do, and not with the rigidity and one would say corporate arrogance that the Patriots have. But the other thing is, you have to remember the contracts in the NFL don't really exist. If you structure a system whereby I give you a $50 million contract, which is actually a $20 million contract because the last 3 years of it don't really count, people are going to find creative ways to negotiate for their clients, and one of the only avenues available is to, as Bill Parcells used to call it, shoot your way out of town, which is pretty much what Deion Branch did.
It's perhaps too early in the season for the fans of any team to be celebrating, but we probably don't want to try telling that to at least 206 Chicago Bears fans, right?
That's right, because they all got the couch. A furniture store owner and quote unquote a huge Bears fan got tired of listening to the Bears brag about their defense, so he offered his clients free furniture up to $10,000 if the Bears shut out the Packers in the season opener. The Bears did that, and Randy Gonigam, the store owner in question, is out $300,000 because 206 customers showed up and apparently backed up the truck.
Speaking of football and furniture, it is customary for Ohio State students to haul their couches out into the road and set them on fire after wins, but I guess things got a little out of hand last weekend, even by Columbus standards.
Yeah, 45 trash bin fires and 4 car fires, and this is only the second game of the season. Can you imagine what's going to happen if Ohio State does, in fact, go along and win the national championship, as a lot of people say? One current and one retired fire official were among the 3 people injured outside the Ohio Student Union, and one of the people arrested was a former Ohio State cheerleader. So it's nice to see they're keeping all the vandalism within the family.
Violence was apparent within the University of Northern Colorado's football community as well, Charlie, and there it had nothing to do with the fans.
No, the second-string punter wanted to be the first-string punter, so in pursuit of that laudable goal, at the University of Northern Colorado, Mitch Kozad stabbed the other punter, Rafael Mendoza, in his kicking leg. And if you think there's a small quiver in the force wherever it is that Tonya Harding is wandering around, you wouldn't be far off.
According to Yahoo Sports, Reggie Bush and his family, quote, appear to have received more than $100,000 from marketing agents while the running back was at USC. What, the Bush family didn't have anybody they were taking care of?
Yeah, if you remember, originally there was a story about Reggie Bush getting extra benefits from a really kind of corrupt and kind of evil agent. Apparently, he's also tied up with some sports marketing people. According to the story, the marketing agents deny it. Reggie Bush denies it. The NFL Players Association is investigating the rent payments, probably to decertify the agents in question if that were to come through. Although why this is any business of the NFL Players Union is anybody's guess. Reggie Bush has gone on to be one of the more exciting players in the NFL. USC certainly got its return on its money. Why anyone should care about this is still beyond me.
Tiger Woods failed to make it 6 victorious tournaments in a row when he got clobbered in a match play event this week, which perhaps wouldn't matter so much if the Ryder Cup weren't a match play event.
Well, I think it should, if people who are watching the Ryder Cup should understand that Tiger was probably going to do a little fishing in Ireland, play a little golf in the West, and wanted out of the world match play, and is not exactly sad to be out of the world match play early. If I were the people who sponsored the world match play, I'd be a little upset. But I can't imagine that Tiger particularly wanted to play the world match play through the weekend and the week before the Ryder Cup. I think if you're a United States Ryder Cup fan, you should be very happy about this.
The NASCAR drivers who will have the opportunity to compete for the Nextel Cup have been determined, unless I mean the Nextel drivers who will compete for the NASCAR Cup have been determined. Anyway, did all your favorites make the cut?
Not only did my favorites make it, not only did the people who've proven their worth through the entire season make it, but people like Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Jeff Gordon, who are the people who are known to the casual NASCAR fan, if such a thing exists, also made it this year. So there will be a little bit interested. Tony Stewart, of course, missed the cut by one spot.
FIFA, soccer's international governing body, is trying to arrange a reconciliation between Marco Materazzi and Zinedine Zidane, whose insults and headbutts marred this year's World Cup final. How much do you suppose tickets to that are going to cost?
Why would they do this?
A question to be asked.
I mean, isn't this controversy? Isn't Zidane's stupidity one of the greatest marketing things that ever happened to worldwide soccer? Everybody knows what happened there. Why are they reconciling? Let them the way Ralph Branca and Bobby Thompson reconciled, you know, down. And it takes 5 or 10 years to get over this, much less using Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned, as the site for this. I think we're being a little bit overdramatic, aren't we?
And finally, Charlie, there's evidence that at least in Cincinnati, somebody still thinks the National Football League needs gimmicks to generate interest.
Well, Chad Johnson, the terrific wide receiver who's known for his end zone dances, he's found another venue. Oktoberfest Cincinnati, as it's called. He's going to lead the world's largest chicken dance.
And
you thought that was a meeting of the president's cabinet.
Music that I just don't want to hear. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His latest book will be out at the end of next month. It's titled Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of the Chicken Dance. Did I get that right?
Yeah, absolutely right.
Anyway, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.